So, everyone can take their seats, we'll get started. Can everyone hear me? Up, louder? Okay. Welcome to the September CRC meeting. We generally start by going around, introducing ourselves, letting people know of any affiliations you have and what part of town you live in. So I will start. I'm Kristen Malone. I'm the CRC chair. I live in St. John's.
Julie Ramos, co-chair in North Portland.
I'm Neil Simon, new CRC member from Southwest Portland.
Michael Luna, Northwest Portland.
Lauren King with the City Attorney's Office.
Anika Bench-Albert, IPR.
Dan Hamilton with Portland Cop Watch and Planning Focus Video Group. Debbie
Arrow, League of Women Voters, Southeast.
I'm Colette Lubin, a citizen that's concerned about police matters and accountability, and I'm from Southwest Portland.
I'm Ted Lubin, Southwest Portland. Herschel Souls, an anti-war activist, concerned citizen, and from Northeast Portland.
Celeste Souls, Northeast Portland.
Mr. Barnett from 40 years in Northeast Portland, and with Cop Watch.
Susanna
Boston,
co-chair of the Police Bureau Training Advisory Council,
Northeast.
Eric Terrell, Northeast Portland, and APA for CRC as needed.
I'm Doug Brown with the Port of Portland Mercury.
With what?
Portland Mercury.
Jeff Bell, captain of professional standards.
I'm Mike Frome, here representing Portland Police Bureau, and I live in Northeast Portland.
Kiasha, it's my turn.
Oh, sorry,
yeah.
David's hiding
behind
the post.
Go ahead. Kiasha Ford, CRC member, Southwest Portland.
Vanessa Yeri, Northeast Portland.
Maricel Rivera, new CRC member from Southeast Portland.
And May File from Kenton.
Before we dive in, I just wanted to draw everyone's attention to the ground rules that are posted around the room. We hope and expect that everyone will follow the ground rules, which basically call for general civility so that we can get through this meeting efficiently tonight. For those of you not familiar, the CRC has several functions. We hear appeals from complaints, from complainants and officers, and publicly report our findings. We gather community concerns about police services, help the IPR director develop policy recommendations to address patterns and problems with police services and conduct, and review and advise IPR and IA on the complaint handling process. Few items on today's agenda, biggest of which is the appeal from a complainant, but we also have old business, including discussion of proposed code changes. We had a use of deadly force work group proposal on our agenda, and I wanted to flag that for people. Jim Young was not able to make it today, and I don't believe anybody else who was involved in creating that is here, so I'm going to go ahead and propose that we skip that. Work group updates and more, which is all to say there's a lot to get through tonight. I hope that we can move efficiently, especially with the appeal, which unfortunately and through no fault of the appellant, we have been here on before. Before we jump in, approving minutes from August 3rd. Anybody have a motion on that topic?
I don't motion to approve.
I second.
Roll call starting with Ms. Ford.
Yes.
Yes.
Abstain. I abstain as Laura was a present.
Yes.
Yes.
Abstain.
Yes.
Great. Motion passes. Minutes are approved. Also wanted to flag for folks here. We have at least two occasions planned for public comment, one prior to our vote on the appeal, and another one, general public comment at the end. So for those of you waiting to know when their turn will come. It will, and that's about when we'll have them, if not more, during some other issues. Director's report.
Independent police review work plan accomplishment. Auditor's proposed culture before the city council. City auditor Mary Paul Caballero proposed to change Portland's police accountability system will be brought in front of city council on September 14th. Among the proposed coaching the following: require that all complaints of officer misconduct are investigated. Require that IPR is notified by the police bureau of all suspected officer misconduct. Authorize the citizen review committee to hear appeals in 3-person panels. Reserve public comment for general meetings of the citizen review committee rather than the appeal hearings, which will be scheduled separately. Recommended findings completed by either IPR or internal affairs based on which office investigated the complaint, as opposed to the current practice of having the involved officers commander write findings. Allows a complainant to be present for at a police review board hearing and provide a statement. Under community outreach, IPR community outreach coordinator Irene Konev was busy this month finalizing the PRB recruitment and coordinating the CRC and PRB 40-hour training. She attended and networked at the National Night Out events, attended and networked the program participants of Healthy Baby Initiative at their graduation celebration, and participated in the Portland Police Bureau's training pilot program, CRC PRB training sessions. IPR and Professional Standard Division have facilitated a series of training sessions every Tuesday since August 16th. The sessions are aimed at providing PRB and CRC members with the necessary information and background to serve on the PRB and CRC. As a result of the DOJ settlement agreement and previous code changes, CRC members serve as rotating PRB members in use of force cases. Prior to serving on a particular PRB, all members will have to attend the training sessions for view video of the training. New CRC members, on August 31st at 9:30 a.m., the Portland City Council appointed 2 new CRC members and reappointed current CRC member Roberto Rivera for 3-year terms of service on CRC. The city is very fortunate to have such a diverse and enthusiastic group of community members willing to serve on the CRC. Anna Mauricia Rivera. Ms. Mauricia Rivera received her Bachelor of Arts degree in psychology from Reed College and her master's degree in social psychology from the University of California, Santa Cruz. She is an executive search consultant at Opus Partners, where she helps fill positions in higher education and healthcare. Ms. Rivera moved back to Portland from Tucson, Arizona, where she worked to create equal access for disabled students at the University of Arizona. Prior to that, she worked as a litigation consultant in San Francisco. Neil Simon. Mr. Neil Simon is a Portland native, former journalist, and bipartisan international government communications director. He led communications for the Human Rights Watchdog U.S. Commission on Security and Cooperation in Europe and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe Parliamentary Assembly, and is well-versed in working with diverse communities, civil society organizations, and elected officials across the globe. Mr. Simon produced several award-winning documentaries, including Prisoners and Patriots, a film about secret Japanese-American internment. He currently teaches a leadership development program for rising cybersecurity leaders and creates content for the CISO Coalition, a catalyst for collaboration among the nation's leading cybersecurity executives run by Inventa, a CEB company. He holds a bachelor's degree in journalism and political science from Northwestern University's McGill School of Journalism. CRC reappointment of Roberto Rivera. Mr. Roberto Rivera has been an Oregon resident for over 11 years. He's a graduate of Concordia University in Portland, where he earned a bachelor's of science degree in healthcare administration. He has 6 years of experience working in nonprofit organizations serving at-risk populations
including 211 info, where he performed community outreach, gave presentation to the public, and assisted with resource database management. Mr. Rivera is currently working as a general contractor for his own business. IPR Sinclair follows at Portland IPR. IPR caseload, number of cases for this week, there's 20 of them, 20 cases, 18 days. Internal affairs caseload, there's 32 at 54 days, and 22 community member complaints, 10 of them are bureau initiated. Waiting assignment, 13 at 31 days, and 12 community member complaints and one bureau initiated complaint. For service improvement opportunities, there are 3, and the median age is 41. Status of the officer involved shootings and custody death investigation, 16, case number 2016B15, that's currently at the chief's office under review. Currently, IPR investigation is a new case that has been opened on March 11th, 2016. There are other ones from this date, starting from May. May 20th, 2016, March 23rd, 2016, and April 19th, 2016. April 26, 2016, and May 3rd, 2016. Have any questions? That's it.
Thank you.
The chair's report this month, and it sounds a lot like the chair's report last month, which is most of my activities have had to do with the proposed code changes affecting CRC, which we will talk about later in this meeting, Co-Chair Ramos and I went to a public meeting at the Maranatha Church on some new revisions to our process. And outside of that, I've been meeting with city officials and community members trying to get a sense of what the plan is and why. And that's what I've been hearing from a lot of other CRC members as well. That was brief. That's it. I note that it is 5:45 and the appeal hearing is set for 6:15. Does anybody know if we are waiting for our appellant? We are. Okay, well then, why don't we skip ahead and circle back when he's arrived or at 6:15, whichever occurs first. Here we are at old business, discussion of proposed code changes to the CRC appeal process. Last time we met, the proposed code changes involved merging our appeal process in with the PRB's process. I know that the new code changes are available at the back of the room. They have been submitted to City Council and will be read next Wednesday. For our purposes, the two biggest changes are reducing the quorum for an appeal to 3 members and eliminating public comment from meetings where appeals are held, and limiting public comment to meetings scheduled to gather general public concerns or to address particular short-term issues or something like that. Discuss. I think there's a lot to say. I've been saying a lot in a lot of places about it, a lot, so this is more for the...
I have a comment. While I'm glad the merged model went away, I'm still very concerned about the idea of an appeal could be decided by 2 people, because the panel would be made of 3 and a quorum is 2, so if only 2 people are there, they could then make the decision. I don't think a panel of 3 gives enough representation of this group. I would like to see the panel grow a little bit, maybe four or five members. And also, well, that's my main comment.
Can I jump in and say, I think that the quorum for the appeal is three.
No, she said it's two.
Who said it's two? All right, I'll look for it.
I don't know if I have a comment. I have a question, and I am admittedly very behind in being the most up-to-date on these proposals and versions of proposals. Did I hear correctly that they're saying they want to eliminate public comment completely from when we're hearing appeals?
Yes, that includes before and also after the vote.
Okay.
So, not to tip my hand too much, but as I said in our standard of review meeting today, if what it takes to hear community feedback on an appeal is scheduling another meeting directly following the meeting on the appeal to discuss the specific short-term issue of how did we do on that appeal, then I'll do it. But that's not a long-term measure, right? You know, the way the language reads is if it's during a meeting when an appeal is held,
there's no public comment.
So if one meeting needs to be adjourned and another meeting needs to begin, so be it, but it seems a bad idea.
I mean, it seems to me, so there's a balancing that we're trying to achieve. We need to be efficient to deal with the growing need, which is excellent. There are more appeals coming. We want more appeals to come, and we want a more robust oversight structure. And to do that, we need to grow and become more efficient in our oversight structure. So the idea of a panel I am not necessarily opposed to, but I agree, I think those are valid concerns to feel if we make the panel too small. Likewise, I think it is concerning. So when it comes to public comment, I understand needing comment to be relevant to the appeal as opposed to just open-ended, but it seems concerning to eliminate it completely from the overall process. And then it just seems very complicated to then create a whole nother meeting if we're moving towards efficiency.
I guess the other part of my comment was I also, in terms of making the panels larger, I would push to increase the size of the CRC.
And I would also say in terms of staffing panels, as I understand it, the way the code change is written, and I still haven't found it, is that it reduces the necessary number of CRC members to hear an appeal to three. But that does not mean three and only three any more than our current system needs five and only five. So the part of the reason I also said we need more people on the committee is because I don't want it to be that three people are assigned to hear an appeal and one person is sick and the appeal just doesn't happen and has to get rescheduled. So I think ideally we use that three as a safety net, but that as many people come as can come as often as possible. But it's not a perfect solution. And another thing that you said about feeling like the consolidated model is gone is that my understanding is that it is not gone, but it's just gone for now. And that all of this is still being planned and workshopped and finessed and is, to my mind, all still being done so too privately, but that the vision ultimately is that the CRC and the CR and the PRB do not both exist to hear appeals or complaints.
So is the reason for limiting or having no public input time?
I don't know. One of the reasons that we have heard involves a speculative, not yet materialized concern that if an officer is ultimately disciplined and files a grievance, that it would go to arbitration and that the arbitrator could look at our record. And for example, if some member of the public was making personal attacks on a participant and the committee overturned a finding or did something, that there could be some whiff of perhaps the committee made its finding for the wrong reasons. Not because of the evidence in the record, but because somebody poisoned the well and we are inflamed or angry or confused, and that removing public comment will address that risk.
And so that we wouldn't be able to parch out that in our decision making.
Well, yeah, it's a little bit
not
a lot of confidence. When Julie and I met with the mayor's office, I made a suggestion that if that's a concern, it's certainly one that's present with juries all the time, and they're routinely instructed not to consider things, and that perhaps when the city attorney reads our standard and all of the information, that some statement could be made about, you know, we consider what's in the file, and that's what we consider, and we already are under an obligation to explain our reasons, so.
Yes.
I don't mean to be tedious, but I'm just recognizing that we have two new committee members on, and we're talking a lot of kind of consolidated models versus different aspects of the models, and I'm wondering if we could get the 30 second kind of like, this was how we functioned, proposal, current state. Is that possible in 30 seconds, or is that?
I'll do my best.
Would that be helpful? Yeah.
So you guys are familiar with the PRB because you trained kind of with them and you know what's going on there. So DOJ settlement occurred. One of the concerns was that our system takes too long and is overly complicated. So a work group met in semi-secret for a period of time, and what came out was a proposal that involved taking away our ability to hear appeals like this and, by some measure, increasing the number of CRC members that participate in PRB hearings. So that would have affected the elimination of a public forum to hear appeals, and would have moved everything essentially into the police bureau, which raised concerns with us about how are complainants going to interact with that system? How are they going to feel empowered? How is the community going to have a voice? How is the community going to have any visibility? And this was a huge concern for us, and I think almost every face I see in this room at a number of public forums. And so that idea was tabled, but the two concerns that had been raised about the timing of appeals and moving them fast enough and the complicated process still remain. And the current proposal to put us into smaller panels to hear appeals is supposed to address the speed issue, because we don't all have to find time to all get together. We can kind of break off and divide and conquer.
I guess I want it noted that it hasn't been clear. We've asked questions several times. Is the timing issue really an issue of the CRC and the appeals, or is it something else? And no one has yet answered that. But they're moving along as if it is.
I would just also like to make one other point of clarification is the PRB has jurisdiction to hear certain cases that we do not hear, and that was part of the reason why there is some benefit to consolidating, because right now the PRB has two community members who serve on it. And so expanding kind of the community presence on that was part of the interest in a consolidated model. Just to kind of add another layer to that is it basically allows the CRC to expand its jurisdiction, but in a way that also retains kind of the structural elements of the PRB. There's a lot of complicated things kind of, I think, happening in here. which is rolling out why certain responses are, you're seeing kind of the PRB is a very closed system and we are much more transparent. And so trying not to, where's the happy medium between the two, basically? And
is there?
Yes, exactly.
We should also note on the record, can you guys hear me? Okay. We should also note on the record the importance of the public comment and how beneficial it has been to us and how it is a serious issue. It's not something that we're taking lightly, the removal of public comment. And that I think it would be very detrimental to the CRC as we know it if we remove public comment from the appeal process.
I agree. I think a lot of people, perhaps a lot of people in City Hall, have heard a lot about more disruptive elements of our meetings of late. But I think that people have missed the reality for years, which is that public comment has really been helpful almost all the time. And on the topic of public comment, can we discuss this amongst ourselves for like 5 more minutes and then open it up? That is the plan.
The other thing I would say to Ms. Ford's note is open public comment is also pretty vital. So, I mean, I think it's helpful getting that feedback in regards to the appeal, but I have also been in meetings where people have made public comment and been able to seek movement on their concerns with the Bureau when before they were kind of getting lost in the bureaucracy. And so I think there's something to be said for people being able to come and raise issues that don't fit within the prescribed agenda that we've come up with. I just remember a meeting we had at City Hall once where a mother came and spoke about her child being arrested and she wasn't getting any momentum otherwise. And so I think there is something we should also note, too, of just allowing a space for people to have it within a committee that serves a function within the oversight system.
That is part of our city code statutory charge, is to gather public concerns. And to me, I think there are two issues. One, which may relate to this whole grievance arbitration scare, which is before we make our decision, are we thinking about the right things? But to say that somebody who sees that there's a meeting of the CRC and comes here because there's an urgent concern or a pressing concern that's a general public concern, but that can't even be heard once we've made our decision, mm-hmm. is troubling.
Can I just, I guess for the last, can you give a status update on the process as it stands now? So they're doing a revision, basically, where is it at? When's the vote? What is our role in terms of giving additional feedback moving forward?
The latest proposal by the auditor is the one that's going before the City Council next Wednesday at 3:45. Before they take their vote, they will take public comment, and then they'll vote.
My understanding is that they will not vote. Who knows?
It'll roll to a second reading. So unless it's an emergency ordinance, which I haven't looked at the ordinance, it would be read, and they'll take testimony, and then there would be a vote the second reading, mm-hmm. which would be the following week.
Would be the following week.
Okay.
Usually.
Julie and I have become familiar faces at meetings about these changes, and I know that the CRC is a very busy group of people, but if anybody can come at 3:45 on Wednesday of next week, I think it would be helpful if we could show up in force and express to them as a group that these changes aren't okay. But let's do 10 minutes of public comment on this topic. Can I get a show of hands of who would like to speak? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 2 minutes each. May will keep time, and we will start with you, sir.
Oh.
My name is Mr. Burnett, 40 years in Northeast Portland, and I'm speaking on my own behalf, not complex at this moment. To me, I think I'm kind of asking for a point of information and a point of clarification. My reading of the assessment of the DOJ was that there were two overriding things that needed to be dealt with, and one was transparency and the other was accountability. And in that context, also my reading indicated that one of the diagrams I think all of you have seen was where about the police a process for accountability was Byzantine. It was unreadable. It was unworkable. Okay? So I'm wondering if this board or this committee is overly concerned about, or is the IPR overly worried about time as it relates to the CRC as opposed to the overall process that people have to go through to get a hearing and appeals and all that. You've all seen that chart, I'm sure, because if you read the DOJ thing, you've seen it. And that, to me, had more to do with how expeditiously situations got dealt with and handled than simply narrowing it right down and putting it on the lap of the CRC. So maybe I'm expressing a concern for a point of information, a point of clarification, because perhaps even the auditor's office is confused when they want to put the whole burden of trying to expedite, make it efficient, etc. Besides, in most human organizations, there is a concept that has, to me, more overriding criteria, and that's effectiveness, not efficiency. Efficiency is a corporate term for producing the most product in the shortest time at the least cost. We're dealing with human beings and human situations, and there should be a prior criteria having to do with is a process effective in addressing justice, not how efficient it can go as if it were a factory.
Thank you.
Next comment.
Hi there, I'm Katie Poole. The biggest thing I actually keep hearing about delays from people who've been through this process is that it's internal affairs that has caused the big delay in their process, and I don't see anything in this proposal that says that they must get their investigation done by this date, so I don't see how anything is going to impact that. And I think, as someone else remembered, as far as transparency, police have union reps. They have paid, like, free lawyers. As citizens, we don't have that. So there is definitely a concern about people being pressured into things behind closed doors just because of the power differential.
Thank you.
How long do I have to talk?
Ten minutes.
Okay, my last name is Eng, and I like that name because it means meadow in Norwegian. I spent all day in court today at room 512. I was in the room with Mark Kruger, who has caused some disgrace and disrepute to the Bureau. I have a theory that I have some Jewish roots in my great-grandmother's side, so I take it really personally that hate crime isn't taken seriously here. But that's not the issue at hand. I just feel particularly traumatized by this, that the city just won't hear my pain. So I think if we focus on listening to people and victims' impact, not sidelining the public and not stigmatizing the public for their input, we can find a way to celebrate all of the unique and diverse voices with an eye towards modern understandings of hate crime and hate bias and how that will impact our perceptions of justice. But I want to thank you all cordially for being here, because this is a great commitment you are showing towards the work in the community. And I just thank you, and I hope that I can always be civil and diplomatic with you while not betraying my conscience in terms of whitewashing any accountability issues that are going on with issues involving hate crime and racism and racist stings against Black people with the Mark Kruger and Vice and Drugs, and in the courtroom today with the harassment of the Jewish man, Mark Kruger, Charles Stones is his name, the Jewish man who was harassed.
Thank you. Yes, ma'am.
My name is Barbara Ross, and over the past 3 years, I have attended a lot of CRC meetings, and I think it's important that you as a CRC defend the right of the public to make comments. In the meetings I have been in, the public has been respectful, and I think the situations where it got out of hand were very few, and in the main, the public had made comments that I thought were helpful to clarify issues. Sometimes some of the public had a historic knowledge about what had been done before, or sometimes they pointed out situations in which the CRC was not abiding by their own protocol. So in general, I don't see public comment as being something that drags the process out. So I hope that you will defend the public's right to comment and work out an efficient way to put that into the process. Thank you.
Perhaps because I live in Germany, I'm really sensitive to the idea of secret police. And I think what this recommendation is shifting from citizen-centered oversight to police-centered oversight. And I think that's a huge mistake. I actually, when I read the documents, I actually felt that what I was reading was an attempt to abolish the CRC by just simply subsuming it under the police review board, where the police are, in fact, in charge, and you're kind of there as support. I don't like the idea of citizens not being in charge of their own democracy. And that's what I'd like you to think about. Constitutional issues, checks and balances, civil authority being in charge. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Hamilton.
Hi, Dan Hamilton with Portland Cop Watch. And I was at the protocol meeting before, so some of you have heard this already. We also sent a letter to the auditor yesterday pointing out that in the existing ordinance, there is a sentence that basically says the CRC, when deciding if the finding is supported by the evidence, that you can't consider anything but what's in the case file. That's the essence of what it said. It would be very easy for somebody to remind you of that, like a jury instruction, before you vote, so that it could even be your chair. Just so that you remember that the public comments aren't necessarily part of the record, but they're very important. And we've benefited a lot from learning from your meetings, and I think contributing to your meetings over the years, and we very strongly oppose the elimination of public comment from the appeal hearings, and the way it's been written, what the chair said, you would have to have a special meeting just to hear public comment. We wouldn't even be able to comment at the end of one of your general meetings. I also have been talking a lot about the police review board. I was surprised to hear the new police review board members went through training, because I don't think their nominations ever went before city council. And we think that most of those members of that board only go to one or two hearings a year. And I think one way to expand your panels, if they won't expand CRC to a larger number, which I know the IPR staff is opposed to for some reason, that you can start integrating them into your process and having them sit in on the appeal hearings. Because I think that would bring them more into the public, and so when they go back to the closed door hearings to hear about shootings and deaths, that they would have more experience listening to the public and having a sense of what the public expects of the police. And I think that's the whole point of having a civilian oversight system. I hope that a lot of you will turn out on Wednesday. We're trying to turn a lot of people out from the community and from different organizations. There was a stakeholder group that sat down in 2010. We were on that, that to help improve the IPR and CRC. There was another stakeholder group in 2000 that we sat on that helped create the IPR and CRC in the first place.
You need
to have a process like that to involve community and discussions rather than having to vote on this right now. Thank you.
Thank you. Was there anybody else who wanted to make comment? Do we as a committee have more to discuss in light of the comment we've heard?
I think it's clear that as many of us as possible that can get in front of council and, you know, let them know that we are not trying to become a closed system. It seems to me that I'm hearing from everyone that we also value and want public comment, and I think that we need to show up and let them know that we are united in that as well. So,
everybody feels that way, right?
Yes.
Okay. Well, I hope that we are all there, or at least most of us are there, but now we know that we can say that everybody that was here felt that way.
I might add something.
Yeah, sure.
Sure. Being new to the process and this being my first public meeting, not as familiar with the history being discussed, and I appreciate the knowledge being shared with me, and really appreciate hearing from you and the public, and regardless of what happens with the new ordinance, I think that it's really comforting and assuring to all of us that we have a group of people on both, you know, sides of the room here, if you will, that are committed to an open process and having public voices heard, even if it means being creative with whatever ordinance we are to deal with. So thank you for sharing your voices and lending it to this process and having your voices heard at council on this important issue as well. But as a new member, you can definitely trust that I will exercise that same creativity to welcome hearing from the public so that we have that extra perspective in our mind regardless of the cases that are in front of us.
Okay, we are 3 minutes away from appeal time. I want to just take a quick break and stretch our legs and wait for the appellant.
I've got it on my work calendar, so
I need
the of the electronic control devices, weapons, whatever they are called, I think is also helpful because I think it takes a very different stance and it's much more explicit in regards to how things should be addressed, much like Ms. Ford was saying. And it's interesting because I think it definitely invites a different look in terms of needing to be more thorough in regards to what de-escalation was used beforehand, as well as where the person was, the fact that he was being held down by three people. I think it's looking at this policy is very important in regards to how we review this, because I think it is much more explicit than the previous policy we were looking at before. That's my point.
I think I agree with Ms. Ford that I kind of seeing this play out and understanding how it played out, the entire situation seems wrong and disturbing and too much. I think that my problem that I'm wrestling with here, and in addition to the standard of review, which is always my problem, but is trying to square this kind of evolving sequence of events that escalated to me from the second the first taser was deployed, which I would think would inflame most anyone who got tased, is to try and figure out how, if at all, this directive technically prevented a barrier from the officer being able to do this. And I think that it might be wrong that the directive isn't written clearly enough to disallow that. For example, I feel like my problem really begins with the first tase. He's up against the wall, his hand, you know, he's pressed, his hands are, at least one is pinned and maybe another one is flailing. I tend to think that's not what active aggression is meant to mean, but I feel like when I read it, I guess you could call it that. I think, unfortunately for me, once he's on the ground, if you look at the video, he's writhing and he's kicking and an officer falls over and there's twisting, and I fully understand why he's doing that, but at that point it seems like the language of the directive fits much more neatly with why you can keep tasing. And everything that I've said bothers me, right? That the fact that you've tased someone and they're having a natural response to tasing and that's why you can tase them again is bonkers. But I feel like the only place that I feel like there might be a violation of the directive, the way I'm reading it, is with the first phase. So
last time I brought up that I've been involved in many restraints when I worked in the psychiatric hospital, and generally in those situations they didn't go well. The patient was actively resisting being restrained, and usually it took time. Because the concern was that you not only kept yourself safe, the staff was safe, but you kept the patient safe. And I know that one of the trainers brought up that the setting is different. The setting is different in a sense that you're in a hospital, but you still have somebody resisting. You still have somebody trying to get out. People can get hurt, including the patient, in those situations. And this setting didn't have any other people around to get hurt. And generally in a hospital setting, you've put move people out of the way. There was no situation where the person was in immediate danger to fall or somehow hurt themselves, and that would be very similar in a hospital setting. So I think the setting isn't a really good argument for this situation, being on the street or in a hospital. Also, the person was on their stomach, and in those situations where a person is resisting, they really can't do much with their hand in regards to hurting someone unless you're in front of their face, and I didn't see any examples where that's where they were. You can get kicked, which is kind of a blind kick possibility, which is usually easy to restrain and get out of the way of. Once it's occurred once, it kind of wakes you up to what you need to do next when you see that occur. And I also noted that one of the officers said that, Officer D said that that he was not being combative, that he was just pulling and jerking his arms, overpowering. He wasn't swinging at anybody at the time. And I also think the directive is good. It's a little clearer to me, and 3.2, that the person did appear restrained. Not necessarily in handcuffs, but restraint could mean they're generally in control, not totally out of control, and that there were multiple officers on them. And the substantial risk, it appears in the description of what he was doing was to possibly get kicked. But again, if once the leg is kicked once, and once they move their leg once, a person that's on top knows they stay away from it. They hold it down. They move it. That's not a hard body part to stay away from at that point. I didn't hear any biting. We've had biters before, which is pretty serious, and I didn't hear that. Hair pulling, which is also another serious aggression. Grabbing onto someone could be, depending on where they're grabbing on. But I, too, am struggling with the word aggression in this case being used in this circumstance. Was resisting? Yes. Not liking what was going on? Yes. And would it have probably taken longer to put this person in actual restraints without using a taser? I believe it would have. And I don't know if there was a reason, a time, from something else going on that it needed to be done in a quicker manner. Three officers seems enough to restrain most people. And I know that sometimes you look at a person and they don't necessarily look like they would be hard to restrain, but I've restrained small people before and they can be difficult also. But I think three officers had control of the situation, and I don't see the aggression occurring from the Mr. Klug in this sense that would that a reasonable person would have to tase them because of fear for physical injury.
To me, it seems like the big difference is what is the line between resistance of arrest and aggression? And I have, and it's very well marked at this time, do not use this policy. But in the policy we used in the last one, exonerated is an appropriate finding. In that old, outdated policy, it says, a taser may be used in the following circumstances. And the first one is, a person engages in or displays the intent to engage in physical resistance to a lawful police action. Physical resistance is actions that prevent or attempt to prevent a member's attempt to control a subject, but do not involve attempts to harm that member, where the member is the police officer. So in that, resisting arrest in this old policy is a reason to use the taser. So now our question at hand is, looking at the new policy, is that same finding appropriate? Is this person resisting arrest, and therefore, and that's all they're doing, and thus the taser is unwarranted? Or was there real physical harm that could be seen from this evidence that the officer could be fearful of? And I think that, to me, seems like the biggest distinction between the two policies.
So then it says in section 2.2 in the directive, specific definitions, that when reasonable under the circumstances, members are authorized to use the ECW in the following situations: in response to active aggression, to prevent suicide when reasonable in light of available options, in drive stun mode in the event of insufficient probe spread or dislodged probe, and there's a little bit more, and to prevent flight from custody when member has articulable reason to believe the subject presents an immediate threat of physical injury to public officers or the subject, or the escape of the subject presents a significant danger to the public, officers, or the subject. So I would think the only one that would be applicable is in response to active aggression. And when I continue to read it, like a threat or an overt act of assault through physical or verbal means, coupled with present ability to carry out the threat or assault. So there's two prongs. Mm-hmm. You either need to, there needs to be a true threat or overt act of the assault and the means to carry him out. If your hands are behind the back, you do not have the means. You might have the means to do a back kick, I guess. You know, if you're like some jujitsu person, you might be able to do a really great karate kick in the back. But outside of that, when your hands are behind your back with a probe in your back, with the tasing, if you're already tased in the back with a hand behind your back, once you hit the ground, you might be flailing, but you're not in a position to do a serious attack. And that's just the concern for me, that he was like, you could see him slammed against the wall, and he's tased then, and it just didn't make sense the first time. So after the first time, I couldn't understand the remaining tases, especially somebody getting tased in the thigh and then probed in the thigh when there's three officers on top of him. It just made no sense to me.
I think I'm also looking at this point at the directive specifically refers to a subject being held to the ground by multiple officers, and thinking about what Mr. Luna said about taking more time and restraining the subject, and it specifically says, and no other reasonable force options are available. And after tasing somebody three times, even believing that it was once, having him on the ground, two officers on his arms, one getting a lock on the legs, to think that the only thing that you can do at that point is tase him, seems, I mean, what happened before tasers in that situation? Surely you didn't shoot someone. So there must be a force option there when a subject is on the ground and you've got three people on them to get that situation under control.
My question, so the other thing, and I don't know if I should bring this up now because it's more of a policy discussion and not necessarily pertinent to the appellant himself, but if this got so far where we were using the wrong policy, what, and again, this isn't relevant because we have to use the policies at hand, but is it reasonable to think, you know, basically what's the training? What is the officer on the ground? Exactly, because the previous policy says, yes, you can do this, and now they're saying, for, you know, because of the DOJ, because they're reducing this, that no, you can't, for a pretty distinguishable thing. And the fact that we kind of went through all of these steps and we're looking at the wrong policy makes me think that probably the officer on hand also is not aware of which policy is in operation, or wasn't at the time.
But at that hearing, Mr. Handelman tried to explain that to us. It did not appear that the Bureau had not read the policy. It appeared that only we had not read the policy. They did not seem to not know their policy was in existence. And ignorance of the law is not an excuse. If it's their policy at the time, they have an obligation to know it. So I don't think that, you know, we can say, well, did he know? And if you go to the findings, at the very end of the findings, the RU finding manager, he says, in summary, I find that the first three taser applications were supported by adequate evidence indicating that appellant was engaging in active aggression in an effort to avoid being taken into custody for a lawful reason. So he is in clear conflict with what we're even thinking. So he was on the page. There didn't appear to be confusion with what was going on and whether or not, well, it wasn't wrong then, but it's wrong now. Seems like, no, we believed it was right then. And he even says the first three taser applications. So it didn't seem to be this confusion of whether the first three were actually three versus one. It's like if they were three or one, they seemed to be adequate. And I think absolutely not.
Another thought that came to me also was that we don't know, officers aren't going to know the medical histories or conditions of people that they're going to tase. And so I would hope that the last resort would really mean the last resort, because we don't know what they could, because they don't tell us necessarily, or they're not wearing anything to tell us that we would know. And so that bothers me too, that I think the assumption should be that this could cause serious bodily harm, and possible death, I guess, also to certain individuals that we don't, and we don't realize it.
I'd also to pile on, but I'd like to kind of bring up the rationale for excusing the sixth discharge, which was the whoopsie-daisy, finger on the trigger situation. And if I recall correctly, the explanation in the findings was that he didn't mean to do it, and that there were good training reasons for why his finger might have been out there. But the fact is, he applied force to the appellant unnecessarily, even accidentally. And I again think that if it was a different type of weapon that went off in that manner, that we would be having a different conversation. And you know, the officer knew where the button was to create that action, and he probably understood that was the same place that his index finger went when he first did it. And it's a terrible design, and it shouldn't have been there. But I feel like we've all had a situation where we said, oh, remember that thing's there, you know, don't step on it, and then 5 seconds later you do. It's an accident, but it has consequences, and I don't think that that should be overlooked. And there is a provision in this policy that deals with negligent discharges, and it talks about an on-duty supervisor will respond, et cetera, et cetera. It doesn't lay out any separate measure for that to be judged by. It seems to suggest that a discharge is a discharge, and that the rightness or wrongness of it should be judged under this standard as well.
I guess when I look at this, similar to Ms. Malone's concerns, it's like, what precipitated the first event? Because once it happened, I can understand somebody being upset and thrashing and moving around. I also am not sure of the thin line between resistance and aggression. And and just reading all of the policies, I mean, force is force, and I believe that force should always be the last recourse in any event with the public, and de-escalation or other things should be tried always first. You know, the videotape was like 4 seconds into it was the tasing, and so it was only 30 seconds. It doesn't show us a lot of what happened before that, but reading all the testimony, again, I'm stuck on that resistance versus aggression thing. And this directive is really clear about when it could appropriately be used. They really lay it out. Which was different than the old directive we had. So, on that.
Just to detour into policy a little bit, I'm inferring from the change in directives that something more than resistance was intended to be conceived of by active aggression, but it would probably be helpful, especially since it's a change, to have that line defined and spelled out, considered. As I'm thinking about this, for me, I have concerns about the initial event. Mr. Luna has kind of started to change my mind about the subsequent cases during the restraint, but I think setting that all aside, ultimately I'm inclined to say that at least based on the sixth discharge, this was unreasonable. At that point, the officer did not intend to tase him anymore. Presumably that means he believed that he was restrained on the ground. And he could articulate no reason for shocking him. So I think there are some thorny issues in the first five discharges, but at the very least the sixth to me is not reasonable.
I'm leaning towards, I guess, a similar thing in the sense that, I mean, under the old policy, I see resistance. Under the new policy, it seems pretty explicit to me in here. As you were saying, I mean, it's fairly laid out. It even talks about being held down by multiple people. It talks about doing more than two charges. I think there's some bigger structural issues. I think that having a taser out there that people are trained to accidentally hit, given that their nature is problematic. I think having policy changes that might not be trickling down is problematic. You know, I think there's some bigger structural issues that need to be addressed, but I think really what it comes down to is this is the policy that was in place. This was the person who was tased multiple times, and I I agree. I think it's hard with how explicit this policy is to not feel that it was unreasonable. Not that it's clear cut, like you were saying, but...
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that the first two are less clear cut, and that's a reason why I feel like, given our standard, I would... I'm not sure, without stewing on it for probably longer than we want to sit and stew, whether I could vote to challenge based on just those, because, again, we've got to give a lot of deference, but I just don't see it on the 6th if we acknowledge that the officer had no reason to discharge the weapon. If everybody's kind of there, that he didn't even mean to do it, I understand that to him it was an accident, but it was negligent. It did hurt the appellant, and that to me seems like a clear path forward in my mind.
I think I'm less concerned with 6, although I do see your point, and more with what Mr. Luna had brought up and what you spoke about 3.2 and how there's no other reasonable force options are available if somebody's kind of restrained and on the ground and there's three people. And I'm not seeing, like you brought up, how there couldn't be some other reasonable option that would be less force than the other tase that happened. That's my concern.
And I'm concerned overall. Just overall. Tase 1 through 6.
I'm just going to try something here. I move to challenge and recommend a finding of sustain.
Second.
Vote starting.
Yes.
Just out of respect for the process, that I wasn't here from the beginning of the case, and while I've read a lot of it and heard the testimony today, I think it's most respectful of the process that I abstained just on this first case. And I hope that you'll understand that.
Can you come back to me?
Sure. I vote yes. I think that the first 5 discharges were problematic and should be looked at, but I think certainly the 6th discharge is inexcusable.
And I also want to just quickly reread the findings, so
sure.
If you guys go, and then I'll come back as well.
Can you also come back to me?
Yes, and because I think that the use of force was a little excessive, and I don't think any de-escalation tactics were even attempted to be used. And I think with the initial tase and the following tases following, it just escalated a situation that could have probably been de-escalated and avoided.
Can we explain our reason now, or are we waiting? Mm-hmm.
Usually you do when you vote.
Oh, do it now.
Yeah,
so I'm sorry.
You already voted yes.
Yes. I believe that the appellant was resisting but not combative and was not aggressive. And I'm using testimony from Officer D, as well as the experience and knowing that it would be difficult, unless there was something else going on, to believe that this person, aggression, was a reason to be tased. I don't think there was aggression going on.
And the reason why I paused was I wanted to reread and look at, I mean, I definitely feel the need to challenge exonerated. I was sitting with the evidence, so not sustained versus sustained. So was there enough evidence to demonstrate that resistance versus aggressive? And I feel there was. I vote yes also to challenge it and propose sustained.
I paused for a similar reason, and also getting stuck on our standard.
Yeah.
But I guess I do find it unreasonable based on the directive as written and the testimony that I read through, so I would say yes, I agree.
I would also say yes, based on, I don't see how a reasonable person could find the tasing when the appellant was on the ground, the appropriate use of force.
Okay,
I
just have a question
about
that. Yes.
I'm sorry. No, I just try to pronounce May's new last name.
Oh, file. Yes, sorry.
I didn't get your reasoning.
Oh, yes. I was saying, well, probably because I didn't explain it. I explained that the reason why I paused was I wanted to look at the evidence, and I said I did believe there was enough evidence, but I didn't explain what that was. And I think looking at how explicit the new policy is, and for me specifically, the being held down by multiple people, which is spelled out in the directive, looking at a pretty overt definition of aggression as opposed to resistance, I feel like it's very defined in the directive. And I think there's a third point, but I can't find the directive right now, so I would say those are the two main points. And then did you abstain?
I abstain voting as well, since this is my first meeting.
6 votes to challenge and recommend a finance to stay, 2 abstentions. What comes next, I bet you know. Your challenge will be sent to the Captain of Internal Affairs to determine whether the Bureau will accept our recommendations. If the Bureau does not accept, I have to tell you this, if the Bureau does not accept, we'll have a conference hearing. You'll receive advance notice of the hearing, and if we cannot reach agreement at the conference hearing, it will go to City Council, and you will also receive notice.
Who is Captain of Internal Affairs since they all got busted down?
Captain Bell.
That would be me now.
All right. There is in our procedure an opportunity to discuss policy, training, or quality of investigation issues to be addressed at a later time. I feel that we've ferreted a lot of those out at this hearing and a past hearing, but let's just among the.
I only have one. I think somebody said that this taser is part of the police force now. Mm. Yes?
Yes.
Okay. So I guess hopefully I have some recommendations around training so that this kind of accidental discharge doesn't happen again.
Well, and I think I am not sure about the training also around changing policies. I mean, I know it has been a huge lift. I think it'd be very difficult to be abreast of all the different changes if it was just left on your own devices. And I'm sure you guys have a training approach and you're probably very thorough, but it seems like it would be very difficult, and I would want to know what's up to date on that, because I agree. I think you're in that position, you need to know, and it's, as the former training division lead, maybe.
Actually, do you mind if I address both of those issues?
Please do.
So this case was brought to the training division's attention due to the apparent accidental activation of the button. And so that was taken into consideration in developing the training that will be given to officers as they transition from the old taser to the new taser. Part of that training was also going to be that if you push the button, you are responsible for the electricity that it delivers. And that was going to be made explicit to officers, because essentially, yes, they are responsible for any activation of the taser. The other issue, I would say in the past, we have not done a good job of making sure people read the policies or that people understand the policies. So a few years ago, we started actually making people electronically sign off that they read the policies. We've now taken that a step further. We've only done it with one policy so far, but we just did it recently with our new 850-20, which is the mental health directive. And basically, the day that policy became effective, there was an e-learning module that everybody was required to watch that included video discussing the content of the policy, discussing some of the finer points of the policy, and then there were actually interspersed throughout the policy. There were a total of 10 questions that they had to answer to show that they had read the policy. The questions were very well written to the point where we, in the training division, got a lot of feedback that people said, I took it the first time and I failed and I realized that I actually had to read the questions and read the directive. So we got a lot of good feedback that the testing portion of the e-learning was actually causing people to sit there and read the directive. So there's a two-tiered approach in that. Mm-hmm. There's the piece when the directive is first released, and each directive that's released here on is going to get a tailor-made training piece, whether that is something like 850-20, which affects a lot of the work we do and is extremely important. Got, you know, a fairly significant e-learning piece along with a second prong where in-service, which starts today, they're going to get training in application of the policy. So there's the initial training piece, and then there's the follow-up training piece the next time they go through in-service. Depending on the directive, that approach will be changed a little bit. It might just be a matter of an e-learning module where they're just asked questions about the content of the directive and they're required to answer those questions correctly, or it might be even more involved. There was recognition that we weren't necessarily having our employees giving them training as these new policies rolled out. So these are some of the steps we've taken very recently to kind of address this. So I hear your concerns. We had the same concerns, and so this is kind of what we've moved forward with.
Thank you. It's very helpful.
That's really good. Yeah.
That does make me feel better. At this point, your next opportunity for comment will be in public comment, which will be right after work group updates, which we will take now. Unless anybody had more policy comments. Okay, work group updates. The appeal has concluded. I don't need to go. For the record. Work group updates.
I can give an update for outreach when we get organized. Okay. Outreach work group met today at 4. I was delayed in getting the agenda out, mostly because I wasn't quite sure because I've been off the map. So it was really a convening at the last two meetings back. We had talked about speaking to a lot of the city council kind of groups that are out there, the COCAL, the COAB, the CPRC. The majority of those groups are on hiatus. So really where we're at now with this group meeting was we are kind of stepping back and doing a little lay of the land assessing, and the hope is to develop a more comprehensive outreach plan. So the focal areas that we are looking at are doing an inventory of our current meetings with city council members. So committee members, you will probably be hearing something from Michael Luna, who's going to follow up to ask who you're meeting with, when, you know, how often are you meeting with them, and generally what you're discussing. We're also going to look into best practices of current councils, not necessarily just the police oversight, but other councils and city committees in terms of outreach. And that's going to be Neil Simon. And then we're going to also take an inventory of what we need to actually implement any of this stuff, because we have a lot of ideas on the CRC, but we don't always have the capacity to do everything. So we're going to just kind of take a little lay of the land on that, too. And that will be the agenda for the next outreach meeting, for the record, for anyone, because I'm doing bad at sending out the agendas. We are going to discuss kind of what those are and where we want to go moving forward in regards to priorities.
Excellent. Do we have an update from the recurring audit group? No meeting yet?
No, we haven't met. We're still waiting for the dismissals from IPR, but we did get the worksheet, and I don't know that Mr. Bissonnette has had a chance to take a look at those yet. So, no updates.
Okay. Policy and protocols?
We met today at 4 p.m. as well. We had a really robust conversation actually about the suggested changes that will be submitted by the auditor to the council next Wednesday at 3:45. Hope you guys can all make it. We didn't get to talk a lot about standard of review, which is actually something that was initially proposed with the consolidated model, but now, which would have been a change to the preponderance of the evidence. But I have recently found out today that that has been either on hold or abandoned, but it's not part of the proposed changes. So that's a little concerning. We're going to, I guess, go back to the drawing board. But we had a very robust discussion about the CRC's stance on the proposed changes, and we got a lot of great community input, and we'll be meeting soon. Any?
Crowd control work group? Nobody's on it.
I think we're still waiting to find out if a proposal or discussion has occurred with
the
chief.
That's the use of deadly force.
Were they being combined?
No. Oh. Crowd control issued a report a little while ago. So this would be a new crowd control work group if this is...
But it had
what you missed is that the report was issued, but it went nowhere. Oh, so okay. We reconstituted the crowd control work group to try and get it somewhere.
So what's your thought? What you keep looking at me?
I think you said you wanted to be on it. That's why you were like, "Yeah, I'll do that." Yeah. Like, right, no.
Okay, so what I'll make a commitment to is finding out where we're at with that and what we need to do next. And that might necessarily mean we don't need another work group, but we just need to proceed with the past one. And I will follow up and make sure we have that next time we meet.
I wrote your name next to it.
Thank you, Mr. Lewis.
Well, David didn't say anything, so it's not official.
Then we've got the use of deadly force work group, which has some stuff in the hopper for us, but none of the people are here today. Jim Young got ill this morning and was not able to make it, but we will hear from that work group next time. Public comment. Show of hands. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Let's do 2 minutes each. 7. Still do 2 minutes each, starting with Mr. Handelman. Sorry to put you on the spot.
Dan Handelman again, Force Cop Watch. Protocol thing, two things that could be done to make things clearer to the audience. One is to explain where the missing members are at the beginning of the meeting, and the other is to just let the appellant sort of express to you if they understood everything that happened at the end, because that's happened in the past. Those are helpful things for the process. I forgot to mention when I was talking about the inadequacy of the case summary file, that even though it was sent back for a new finding based on the correct record, there's no indication of that. There's no reasoning about why the finding was applied again based on the directive. So that's very confusing for people trying to figure out what's going on. I appreciate being given the credit around the correction on the directive. I expect Mr. Klug, who noticed it was the wrong directive, we just tried to make sure that you would listen to him and take his evidence that he had in hand for you, which you're allowed to do, and you did tonight. So I thank you for doing that. I'm very confused because Mr. Klug described, and I thought this was agreed on last time, that there was a warning arc done by the taser before the 5 other applications, and now that seems to have gone away from the official narrative. I'm glad that Captain Bell mentioned that the officer is supposed to sign off on the directives within 30 days. That's part of the DOJ agreement, and I don't know if that was in place at the time, but if it was, that means this officer should have known what the directive was. The crowd control work group was supposed to be adding boxing in, or kettling, as some people call it, to the recommendations that were made before. That wasn't on the table last time. We decided not to talk about that. And the new Cop Watch newsletter, People's Police Report number 69, is available, and we want it. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yes?
Carol Cushman, League of Women Voters. I was going to say this on the comment during the hearing and then thought it wasn't appropriate. I think it maybe was, so I want to say it now. My thought on the allegations, it seems to me there should have been another allegation added, but I guess you can't add it, or couldn't have. But it seems to me that somewhere training division should have been held responsible for what happened here. And if the RU manager said that the guy didn't understand the owl that he was using and discharging again, that to me was a training problem. And if training in some way signs off and says this guy has been trained, the person that signed off and said that guy had been trained should have been held accountable for what happened as well.
So I want to, Debbie, I'm a League of Women Voters. I want to follow up on her comment, on Carol's comment. If you go back to the Eileen Luna Firewall report, which was done in 2008, it was an independent assessment of the our oversight system. She recommended back then adding supplementary findings such as training failure, equipment failure, communications failure, supervisory failure, so that you could identify things that contributed to the incident but weren't the officer's fault. And so that's something that it's sort of a policy matter for you all to consider when you have time, because it's something you might want to recommend to City Council that be added to the ordinance. And then second thing, I have a comment for the IPR staff. You know, we keep hearing about all of these appeals that are pending. I think it'd be nice to add that to the director's report, you know, how many are lined up and ready to be scheduled. So that's that would be something I think that would be helpful for all of us to really understand the full scope of the problem. Thank you.
Yeah. I'm Barbara Ross. I just wanted to comment briefly on the need for more de-escalation initiatives and activities, because the original crime that this person did was he banged on somebody's car and he was mad because she hit him. All right, we don't have any real evidence that this person was going to assault the police or that actually he was trying to get away. So the fact that this escalated into something where he was thrown on the ground, stomped on by three, or held down by three officers, tased all these times, taken to jail, and ultimately this big brouhaha over the fact that he hit somebody's car with his fist. Now, that wasn't a good thing for him to do, but it wasn't, you know, it wasn't a crime. And so I think we need to think about, okay, what could have been, in terms of just thinking it through. Now, you know, you can't undo something that's happened, but you can think ahead. If somebody's done something fairly minor, do we want to really have this turn into a power struggle between three officers and one very mad individual?
Thank you.
Ms. Ng?
Hello, I'm Mary Ng here. Sir, what was your name again?
Jeff Bell.
Bell, and just B-E-L-L? Okay, I hope I might have to ask you again. Nice to know that you're head of internal affairs, is that correct?
Yes.
So John Rhodes works under you?
Yes.
So John Rhodes is investigating the brutality that Charlie Hales put on me for talking about the sexual harassment case of Rachel Andrew and Lindsay Hunt. So the moral of those cases was we retaliated against lady cops who whistleblow, but I'm not even a cop, and I just talked about the cases, then I had to get brutalized. So maybe we'll cross paths, because I was trained as a paralegal, and I have this sort of funny feeling about, like, wait a minute, don't attack the paralegals. That's just, or the cop watchers, you know, if there are a bunch of cameras rolling, that's not. So hopefully we can get through this, because I really could have clicked with John Rhodes, and he seems like a nice guy. We're going to work on who told the lie to 911 to get the brutality started. The DA's over it. It was a fake case. So I'm glad that he's here, and I'm just so honored, and I'm sorry I'm so late in the game to hear about this. And I hope that maybe he has a role training or sharing his story. Maybe we can do something really positive out of this. Thank you.
Thank you. Yes, sir.
Thank you for allowing me to speak again.
last time I was here was May 4th. And, you know, some and many crazy things have happened with these folks since we left here last time. They were all high-fiving, and it was Commander Bob Day and some other folks and Daryl Turner, and they high-fived on the way out the door. And then a couple days later, I got this letter that said, oops, our bad, we didn't do this correctly. And now we got some different folks after all those 16 management folks all got busted down. Now, you're really trusting these people is what I'm asking you. And the guy who they're investigating from the Office of Internal Independent Police Review is now investigating the former chief. Well, for an inadvertent discharge of a weapon, that's a state charge. That's the same charge that could be leveled against Officer B. Don't you understand? The inadvertent discharge of a weapon is a state charge. Where the hell is Ellen Rosenblum? I'd like to thank Mr. Luna for bringing up the fact of the statement made by Witness Officer D. Witness Officer D, I know for a fact, is an enhanced crisis intervention team member. And that statement speaks volumes because it came from someone with the enhanced CIT training. I'd like to thank all of you for volunteering. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Sir, did you have a comment?
Yes.
White shirt. Yes. I thought you had raised your hand.
Yeah, I'm Peter Parks. I'm a community member, and I'm a longtime union member, and I work with social justice and workers' rights groups. I appreciate the discussion here tonight. It was, I think, my first time hearing this kind of a thing, and I really appreciate the depth that you people looked into this and expressed your feelings about what had happened and what should have happened. I'd like to make just a few comments about the proposed changes to the process and to this group, the CRC, that are being made now. And I really think it's important that citizens like me are able to come here and give testimony. I am very upset that the police union has some control over what happens with things like this. And that I know this is maybe not the right place to say this, the city council members should be cognizant of that, of what's going on, and they should not allow the union in their bargaining to come up with things that control things like this bond.
Thank you.
I just want to thank you, too, for staying for public comments.
Thank you.
Thank
you.
May I have one more thing? Really? Very short.
It's very little.
Very short. Okay. When you go to City Council, I hope you'll also encourage them to get rid of the conference hearing and let the cases that where the Bureau disagrees with you go straight to City Council. That's how the system was originally designed. It's just another waste of your time. It's just another thing that stretches out the whole system.
There's no more comment. We will adjourn.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.